One of the great young literary voices of the late 20th century has died. David Foster Wallace wrote the critically acclaimed 1996 novel Infinite Jest. He was found dead in his home in Claremont, California on Friday. Wallace's wife told police that he hanged himself. David Foster Wallace developed a cult following in the 1980s with his early works, but it was Infinite Jest that gained him widespread attention. The novel was set in the future, in an era of hyper-commercialism. It revolved around a fictional film that was so entertaining, anyone who watched it could die, because they wouldn't want to do anything but watch it. Infinite Jest featured a massive cast of characters sprawled across more than 1,000 pages, and there were hundreds of footnotes. Critics raved. In fact, Time magazine named Infinite Jest one of the 100 best English-language novels from 1923 to 2005. But Wallace told PBS's Charlie Rose that he found the attention a little strange.
I didn't read a whole lot of the reviews, but a lot of the positive ones seemed to me to misunderstand the book. I wanted it to be extraordinarily sad. And not particularly postmodern or jumbled up or fractured. And most of the people, the reviewers who really liked it, seemed to like it because it was funny or it was erudite or it was interestingly fractured.
A year after Infinite Jest was published, the MacArthur Foundation awarded Wallace a genius grant. Wallace's later work included nonfiction, short story collections, and essays on filmmaker David Lynch, tennis star Roger Federer, and Senator John McCain. David Foster Wallace is dead at the age of 46.
The war in Iraq has been President Bush's war, but the commander-in-chief that Bob Woodward depicts in his latest book seems committed to the war, but often careless about strategy and implementation, maintaining what Mr. Woodward calls an odd detachment from its management. Mr. Woodward's latest book, his fourth about decisions in the Bush White House, is The War Within, A Secret White House History, 2006-2008. Bob Woodward joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I think it's safe to say that you've been on a few other shows before we got to you this week.
Yes.
And we're very pleased to have you. But because of that, I want to talk about both some of the revelations in your book and give you a chance to answer questions that have been raised about the book. The U.S. was listening to Iraqi President al-Maliki's decision-making process, let's call it that way.
Spying on him.
That's another way of putting
yes,
it.
Yes, that's the English way of saying it.
How extensive was this?
To the point that one of the sources who knows about this told me we know everything he says. Others say you can't ever know what anybody says all the time, but clearly it is a major effort.
Given all the questions that had been raised about Mr. al-Maliki's loyalties, would it have been irresponsible for U.S. intelligence not to put an ear to him?
Well, there's an interesting question. As President Bush has said repeatedly, trusts Maliki. They talk frequently. People in the embassy and U.S. command in Iraq deal with him regularly. But the problem is simply that you get information about what he's saying and doing, and you focus on that when you should be focusing on what we're doing. And I am a prisoner of going back to Watergate many decades ago, but Watergate really began with the spying on friends.
You suggest that most of the high-ranking military commanders who were consulted were opposed to what we now call the surge. Some people who defend President Bush's conduct of the war will point out we have civilian control of the military for a reason. The president makes those decisions, not military commanders.
That's right, as it should be. That's not the issue. The issue is, did President Bush develop a relationship with senior military leaders so they really were advisors? What was interesting about the first part of this secret review was that no one from the military was included. The military recommendation was to send 2 brigades. And I asked the president, where did it get up to 5? And Steve Hadley was the National Security Advisor in the Oval Office and chimes in and says, well, it came from Steve Hadley's discussions with General Pace. And the president just said, okay, I don't know that. I'm not in these meetings, you'll be happy to hear. Now, this is one of the most important decisions he's made.
The president said this to?
To me.
Your book suggests that the troop surge of 2007 was perhaps not the primary factor behind the steep drop in violence we've seen over the past 16 months. Well, why don't I get you to rein in?
Well, the surge was part of it, but I point out that there are top secret operations going on that really had tremendous impact in the drop in violence because the operations allow us to locate, target, and kill key leaders and players on the other side. Also, the Anbar Awakening and all of the Sunnis coming over, tens of thousands of them, to our side. And then the radical Shia leader Muqtada Sadr's stand down that was ordered in August of 2007. So these four parts all converge.
Your books depend on people talking to you, if not exclusively, at least speaking with you in depth.
I try, yes.
Do you sometimes run the risk of necessarily reflecting the perspective of people who will talk to you?
Sure,
always. And then perhaps at the sacrifice of people who don't give you interviews?
I try to reflect the point of view of the president, the vice president, and his role in this, though it's not large. Mm-hmm. Secretary of State Rice, Rumsfeld, some of the intelligence people, Steve Hadley, the National Security Advisor in the White House, because they're part of the decision-making process. That's the focus.
But does it wind up sometimes sounding like Steve Hadley's story? Because he spoke with you, I gather, at great length.
It's not Steve Hadley's story. It's the president's story. He's the focus, because this is in the tradition of accountability reporting, that the president should be accountable for his decisions and actions.
Bob Woodward, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In our studios, Bob Woodward. His new book is The War Within, A Secret White House History, 2006-2008.
The playwright Tennessee Williams once wrote a stage direction about one of his fragile female characters, Laura, in The Glass Menagerie. Williams wanted the music to suggest the quality of looking at a piece of delicately spun glass. He wrote, "You think of two things, how beautiful it is and how easily it can be broken." That's the critic's dilemma, says Daniel Mendelsohn. They worry about beautiful things and fret that they may be broken.
This interconnection between the stuff that you find beautiful and also how easily it's damaged is a sort of a core theme of so much of Greek tragedy and obviously of all kinds of literature. And it just seemed to me, since a lot of what I do in my criticism is to sort of look at how great works of literature, not only classical, but everything from Homer to Virginia Woolf, are reinterpreted and adapted and sometimes hijacked by contemporary culture. Since that's so much of what I write about, it just seemed like a good title.
And so, How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken became the title of Daniel Mendelsohn's new book of critical essays. Mendelsohn is a classicist. He reads Latin and ancient Greek, but he uses the classics to look at popular culture, books, movies, or plays. For instance, he calls Tennessee Williams the 20th century descendant of Euripides because they both loved doomed women, like Blanche DuBois in Streetcar Named Desire. And I asked if Williams' characters were tragic in the Greek sense.
No, I mean, I don't think so. I think that, in a Greek tragedy, you see somebody screwing up in some terrible way and how that plays out. And in a certain way, what Williams is interested in is looking at the way it plays out when the mistakes are already made. Blanche has already screwed up. She's already lied. She's already slept with the local boys before she gets to New Orleans. She's already done it. And the play is about watching how that all plays out as a result of her coming into contact with this sort of reagent who is her brother-in-law, Stanley Kowalski. So it's a slightly different emphasis. But of course, as something he has in common with Greek tragedians is he loves to see crazy women fall apart on stage.
Most of the 30 essays in Mendelsohn's book were published in the New York Review of Books, and they range from Medea on Broadway to a novel about Henry James to the film Brokeback Mountain.
One of the things I was trying to do was to read not only the movie, which I loved, but to read the reactions to the movie and to read the culture as a whole. I mean, that's what we do as classicists. We're not just reading the Iliad or just reading Euripides. We're looking at what Bronze Age culture was like. What are the tools? What are the other poems being written? Who are the people? What are the politics? The same thing for Athens, which produced Greek tragedy. So I'm, you know, one of the things I do in my reviews is to look not only at the work, but to look at the reception. And in the case of Brokeback Mountain, what fascinated me was that the surround of the movie, the cultural surround, was, I thought, deeply false. You were constantly being told that it was a love story like any other, which, you know, one can see the appeal of that line to the producers of the movie because they're trying to get everyone to see it. But, you know, my point is, read this movie carefully. It's not a love story like any others. These people have different problems even from other star-crossed lovers, like, and the example that I used was Romeo and Juliet. You know, these people not only have to deal with social condemnation, whatever, they have to deal with themselves. They grew up being taught to hate themselves. Because they're gay, right. And so to deny the specificity of that to the movie struck me as a move that diminished the movie, because this movie was wonderful in at least one sense, because it does what all serious art does, which is to take something very specific and to treat it, and this is just the alchemy of good art, in a way that makes it accessible to everybody else.
You know, I always think of good criticism, Daniel Mendelsohn, and certainly what you've got here in this book, as something that challenges us to think more acutely or to revisit old conceptions or somehow in a new way more fully experience the experience. And for all those reasons, I might have thought that you would avoid quote-unquote reality films like United at 93, which recreates, if you will, the doomed flight that crashed in Pennsylvania on September 11th.
It's not necessarily something I would have chosen to write about, all other things being equal. But, you know, here again, the classics connection comes in, because one of the very few remaining plays that we have by Aeschylus is actually the only extant play in Greek tragedy that treats an actual historical event, which is the invasion of Greece by the Persians. And so my training as a classicist, and specifically as somebody who writes about tragedy, made me interested to see how a contemporary mass entertainer, because you have to remember, Greek tragedy was a mass entertainment. It was not something reserved for the upper elite, how our mass entertainment would treat our own recent historical trauma. And so I was very interested, in fact, to see United 93 and the Oliver Stone movie called World Trade Center. And I was dismayed to a certain extent by how small and parochial and safe these movies were in treating this event, in their refusal to sort of think of the larger ramifications. And as somebody who's fascinated by reality TV, I was very interested in the claims made by the United 93 movie to be a sort of a straight representation of reality with no Hollywood garnish. Because, of course, there was garnish. You know, there was music, right? Mm-hmm. There was music.
But when Aeschylus writes about the Persians' defeat, how do you think he's being more emotionally honest than, say, the filmmakers of United 93?
Well, I think in a way I would even say emotionally honest, yes, but even intellectually and ethically and morally honest. Because what Aeschylus does, he makes a remarkable gesture. He is an Athenian writing 8 years after the enormous Persian hordes invaded his hometown, Athens, and, you know, they burned the temples to the ground. I mean, they destroyed a lot of the city of Athens. Then the Greeks win. And then 8 years later, Aeschylus writes a play called The Persians, which, and, you know, he would have been within his rights as a person writing an entertainment for the Athenian people to gloat over this amazing victory. And what he does instead is he writes a play about what it must have been to be a Persian, to be the king of Persia returning home in defeat. And to my mind, that's a remarkable, really ethical gesture. And, you know, of course, what one got out of United 93 and World Trade Center, if you got anything out of it, was, you know, Americans are heroic. And I'm not saying for a moment that Americans weren't heroic. That's not my point. But I think that in the first major popular culture comment on 9/11, one wanted a wider imagination of what this event meant.
Daniel Mendelsohn's new book of criticism is How Beautiful It Is and How Easily It Can Be Broken. He's also the author of The Lost, The Search for Six of 6 Million. Daniel Mendelsohn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Trailers can build buzz for a movie, but what can they do for books? Well, as Jesse Baker reports, the publishing industry is trying to find out.
This is not a film coming to a theater near you, but it sure sounds like it.
I'm getting on every other call. All the odd-numbered ones, starting with this one. Obvious, really.
And his wife is the boss of Pam.
She's one of those women that burns calories just by breathing. I should be jealous, really, but I can't be. I must be a very nice person. Chubby, but nice.
It's not promoting a movie. It's promoting Matt Beaumont's novel, Small World. Book trailers are tailor-made film shorts to lure potential readers into bookstores.
Movie trailers work for movies. Maybe I'll do something for books.
That's Sheila Clover. Clover can trace her roots in the book trailer industry back to 2002. Then, she was an aspiring writer looking for some way to make her book stand out. She thought, why not a book trailer?
When I first Googled the term back in 2002, it wasn't there. You know, there was nothing there, which is funny if you Google it now.
Clover saw an opportunity there and went for it. Her company, Circle of Seven Productions, is now one of many where authors and publishing houses commission trailers to market their work. Trailers are not meant to be cinematic versions of the books they advertise. More, they're an attempt to catch your eye, in hopes you'll remember the author's name, or at least the title of their book.
My name is Seth Greenland, and I've written a new novel called Shining City. It's set in Los Angeles, so naturally, it begins in a hot tub with a pimp and three hookers.
Book trailers have become standard operating procedure in the world of publishing, on display at publisher and retail websites, and of course, on YouTube. Lisa Gallagher is a senior vice president and publisher at William Morrow.
We're trying to put these videos in front of potential readers in the hope that they will be interested enough to pick up the book. And we really can't forget that's the ultimate goal.
So while you might see some of the more highly produced samples in a theater before a movie, you're most likely to find these trailers online.
I, Root Carbunculus, am invited to participate in the first magisterial treasure quest of Dreyan.
The publishing industry has seen the success of viral videos, and they're looking to get in on a little of that action themselves. In order to stand out from all the outrageous things on YouTube, authors have to make their videos pop. Again, Lisa Gallagher.
It means that our videos have to be compelling. They can't be, you know, they can't be poorly produced, otherwise there's no real point to doing them.
But not all trailers are compelling, and not all are authorized by authors or publishing companies. This trailer was made for a school project about The Catcher in the Rye.
See, that's the thing about girls. Every time they do something pretty, even if they're not much to look at, or even if they're sort of stupid, you always fall half in love with them.
Some trailers use a dramatic voiceover, but most rely on pulsating music and pretty fonts to push the books. Author Alexandra Sokoloff says she'll never try to market another book again without a trailer.
There's a certain audience, like the paranormal romance audience, expects a trailer at this point. They've seen them from their favorite authors and they expect to have a trailer so they can check out the book.
It's not only publishing companies and high school English teachers that are taking this seriously. Last year, Oscar-nominated director Alfonso Cuarón made a trailer for Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine.
And the best way to stay oriented, to resist shock, is to know what is happening to you and why.
For NPR News, I'm Jesse Baker.
And you can watch these book trailers at npr.org.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
If real news about politics isn't quenching your thirst, you can always turn to fiction. Our series, Three Books, continues today with recommendations for three political novels. Our guide is Dick Meyer. He's the author of Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium, and NPR's editorial director of digital media.
In American politics, truth has always been much more entertaining than fiction. There are few great novels about our 200 years of politicians and their power-seeking antics. The accepted classic of the genre is Democracy by Henry Adams, a novel as dry and dusty as its title. And then there's Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men. Drawn from the life and times of Louisiana's Huey Long, this is a poetic and unforgettable book. but to say it's about politics is like saying War and Peace is about War and Peace. The three political novels I like best are all addictive, incisive, and generous with humor. Alan Drury, a recovering reporter, invented the modern Washington novel in 1959 with advice and consent. This is a wily, knowing thriller that turns on a Cold War confirmation battle. It so perfectly captures the spirit of these intrigues and the souls of the combatants that 90% of the books and movies about Washington ever since seem like stale imitations. More remarkably, the players in real-life dramas such as the confirmation fights of Robert Bork and Clarence Thomas or the impeachment of Bill Clinton appear to have been imitating Drury's characters. A post-Drury political novel that nails the anthropology of power Washington with snarky wit is Shelley's Heart by Charles McCary. McCary, for my money, is the best American spy novelist ever. He's our John le Carré, and Shelley's Heart is his best Washington novel. Published in 1995, it is set during the first inauguration of the 21st century. The writing is pitch perfect, though McCary stocks the plot with some familiar ingredients. Conspiracy, assassination, a constitutional crisis, a sleazy reporter, and a tragically drunken House leader. But some of the characters are deep and vivid. It also has an eccentricity and sense of humor rarely seen in the genre. My all-time favorite political novel takes place in the capital city of Albany, New York, not Washington. It's Roscoe by William Kennedy, the seventh novel in his cycle of Albany novels. Roscoe is Roscoe Conway, the brains behind Albany's political machine in the middle of the 20th century. On VJ Day, Roscoe decides to get out of politics after years as his party's resident fixer and philosopher. "I'm a fraud," Roscoe tells his crony Elisha. "I've always been a fraud." If Roscoe Conway wants to stop being a fraud, which he does because he wants to find love, he figures he must quit the party and leave politics altogether. A clean soul and an open heart aren't compatible in Kennedy's novel. It's a book that peers far deeper into the heart and conflicts of the people who do the daily work of politics than any Washington novel ever has. All three of these fabulous political novels are a perfect tonic for this long campaign.
NPR's Dick Meyer is the author of Why We Hate Us. He recommended Alan Drury's Advise and Consent, Shelley's Heart by Charles McCary, and Roscoe by William Kennedy. Incidentally, Shelley's Heart is out of print, but it's scheduled for reissue early next year, and then there's always the library. You can find more three books recommendations at npr.org.
It's been said that laughter is the best medicine, but John LaPuma suggests that food can be good medicine, too.
With a whopping 460 milligrams of potassium, a banana is really good for you. Provided you're careful with the peels. So, how do you get more bananas in your diet? You eat them au naturel. Or you can try my great recipe for coconut banana tapioca pudding.
LaPuma is known as Chef MD and has written the Big Book of Culinary Medicine. In it, there are recipes that he says can help you prevent cancer, cure constipation, and lose weight. He, in fact, has lost 35 pounds. He also promises that the dishes are delicious. John LaPuma, a.k.a. Chef MD, joins us from Clear Channel Studios in Santa Barbara, California. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Leanne. It's great to be with you.
Give us a brief definition of culinary medicine.
I say that culinary medicine blends the art of cooking with the science of medicine to give you what I think is restaurant-quality food that, as you pointed out, helps to prevent disease and in some cases actually helps to treat it.
Were you a doctor that went to cooking school or a chef that went to doctor school?
I still am a doctor who went to cooking school.
How did that happen?
I was 35 pounds overweight. I was in a very high-stress position, and I loved the position, but I gained a lot of weight. And I found I wasn't able to keep it off myself, and I didn't know what to tell my patients about what to eat when they asked. So I decided to go to cooking school to learn how to make a healthy diet taste good. And I try to give people the same message, to tell them, look, you have more control than you thought. 70% of all heart disease is preventable. 80% of all cancer is preventable. Here is a food lover's roadmap to preventing disease with what you eat and losing pounds.
Were there foods that actually surprised you when you found out that they had health benefits?
Nuts, I think a lot of people are afraid of. Nuts still have that stigma about being fattening. And of course, if you eat too many of them, they're definitely fattening. But in fact, almost every tree nut you can think of has been shown to lower LDL cholesterol, or what I call lousy cholesterol. And toasted almonds taste a lot better than cholesterol medication.
Now, I've heard that green tea is supposed to help slow the aging process. Is this true?
That depends who you ask. Green tea has a lot of benefits, including reducing risk for heart disease and for breast cancer, interestingly. And as importantly, it can taste good.
But do you think it's really possible to eat foods that make us look younger?
Well, I think looking younger and feeling younger and actually becoming measurably healthier all work together. So in ChefMD, what we're trying to do is give people an easy new approach to what to eat and simple, small things. For example, if you store a watermelon properly on the kitchen counter and not in the refrigerator, it increases in beta-carotene and lycopene, and you need the beta-carotene and lycopene to prevent rusting in your arteries. And rusting in your arteries is what gives you impotence, gives you stroke, gives you heart attack, gives you premature wrinkling, for that matter.
So it's easy to follow your plan, even if I'm on a busy schedule. I don't really have the time to go out and buy fresh ingredients all the time. I, you know, get home from work, I'm real tired, and I just want something quick and easy.
Everybody does. Heck, I have that kind of schedule, too. I think people make eating right too hard. All the recipes in the book take 30 minutes or less. They have 10 ingredients or less. And they're made with simple cooking methods. A little bit of cooking carries a big benefit. Actually, cooking carrots allows you to absorb more fiber in from the carrot. Actually, one of my favorite tips, Leanne, is that if you add rosemary to a marinade, you reduce the cancer-causing chemicals that form in high-heat grilling by 77%. Plus, you get the deep Mediterranean piney tang of rosemary.
Forgive my skepticism, but, you know, things seem to change every day. I mean, one day oat bran is good for you. The next day it doesn't claim to do what it's supposed to do. Dark chocolate, red wine. I mean, every day there's something new. How are we to believe that these foods actually have medicinal properties?
I think the way to understand it is that it is an evolving science, that nutrition is not perfect and it does seem to change every day. So the best things to do are to look at eating patterns. Eating patterns are like the Mediterranean diet, a low-fat diet, a vegetarian diet. Foods are not pharmaceuticals. They don't have the pinpointed action that drugs do. But eaten together, and that's why I have recipes, frankly, I think the proof is in the individual pudding, as it were. So follow the plan. Try what I suggest for gout or arthritis. It's the best scientific data available, and it's going to taste way better than anything you find in a medical textbook. And give it a go.
Dr. John LaPuma, also known as Chef MD, is the author of The Big Book of Culinary Medicine. He joined us from the Clear Channel Studios in Santa Barbara, California. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Leanne.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.